Now this is a chapter of God's Word which is full of many kinds of cruelty and treachery and depravity. It's a chapter that is full of blood. And if there is a natural bit in you that is rather sickened by all this murder and violence, and if you wonder why these terrible stories have been allowed to appear in the Word of God, then you must go into the New Testament scriptures for your understanding. If ever you are perplexed by a passage in the Old Testament, the only way to understand it is to read it with the eyes of Jesus Christ. Because this is the only Bible that Jesus Christ ever knew. Jesus knew these stories, and he read them, and he preached on them in the synagogue. And so to find a true understanding of and a deeper appreciation of these terrible events, then we must go into the New Testament. And this is what the letter to the Hebrews has to say about these Old Testament stories. It says, they were shadows of things to come. That's to say, the relationship of the Old Testament to the New is not the relationship of law and grace, as so many Christians preach. It's the relationship, and can I use these words because I was brought up on them by John MacLeod from Stornoway, my boyhood minister. The relationship of the Old Testament to the New Testament is the relationship of type to antitype. It's the difference between shadow and substance. It's the difference between a photographic negative and the actual photograph. Now, if you want to see what somebody looks like, you can look at the person, of course. But if the person's not there, then you look at a photograph, which is a representation of the person. But supposing you don't have a photograph, supposing you only have a black and white negative, well, you could look at the negative and it would tell you something about the person. Was she wearing a hat? What kind of shoes had she on? Was she carrying a handbag? And so on, just by looking at the black and white negative. Of course, you've got to change it, because the black becomes white and the white becomes black, and the greys tend to stay grey. But just by looking at the negative, you could tell something about the person. And so it is in the Old Testament. It's the relationship between shadow and reality. And whenever you come to these difficult passages, the way to understand them is to see them as shadows of something else. For example, King David was the shadow. Jesus Christ, David's greater son, was the reality. In other words, David was a type of Christ. He was a sort of Christ. Just as King Solomon was a type of Christ, David was a man of war. And he is a type of Christ militant. Solomon was a man of peace, and he is a type of Christ, the peacemaker, the man of peace. Shadow and reality, type and antitype. Here's another example. Am I confusing you? I hope not. Israel was a shadow. The kingdom of Christ is the reality. The sacrifices of the Old Testament, the sacrifices of bullocks and rams and goats and lambs, they were shadows. The cross of Christ was the reality. These sacrifices were just types. They were the forerunners. They were the negative prints of the great sacrifice, which was the antitype and the reality and the actual thing. And so, when we come to the revolt of Absalom against his father, the revolt of Sheba, the man of Belial, the man of Benjamin in this chapter, the revolt of Sheba against David, then we must understand these as shadows of the spiritual conflict that we enter when we enter Christ. The Apostle Paul says, these words are often quoted, and they cannot be quoted too often. He says, "We Christians are not fighting against flesh and blood. Our real enemies are never the enemies we see. We may think so. We may think that it's our job to fight bars and gambling and bingo. And pornographic films about the Holy Son of God. My God, are men not afraid? Sinless Jesus, what next? There's a petition going round the churches of Inverness. I think we'll join in, perhaps starting next Sunday, and sign our names and send them to the Prime Minister or somebody in charge of such affairs. Thank God that the Prime Minister had the courage to speak out. He was brought up in Christian circles, you know. He was brought up as a Baptist, although he admits himself that he drifted for many years before he came back to Christian things in a sort of way. Thank God that he spoke up. But pornography is not our real enemy. It's what behind the pornography that we are fighting. Paul says, we Christians are not fighting against flesh and blood. The chappie in Denmark who's thinking about this horrid thing, that's not our real enemy, but against principalities and powers. The enemy behind the enemy. The battle behind the battle. Principalities and powers against spiritual wickedness in heavenly places. Or as it can be translated, spiritual wickedness in the heavenlies. It's a spiritual fight. And these battles and all this bloodshed in the Old Testament is just a shadow and a type and a forerunner and a negative of the real battle that is to come. Hebrews says that the Old Testament stories are shadows of the things to come. Now, this is a terrible chapter. It's full of blood, and the blood rises to the surface in three places. First of all, in the division of God's Old Testament church, 10 tribes against 2. Wherever you get division, you find the enemy of souls at work. It is Satan who divides Christians. God doesn't divide Christians. God unites his people. One church. But when Lucifer gets loose, then he fragments the work of God and the people of God. And so even at this early stage, you find the 12 tribes beginning to fragment. And this fragmentation was something that persisted right through their history. so that after the death of Solomon, they actually became two kingdoms. If you care to look for a second at chapter 20, and these words there, the words used by Sheba when he started his rebellion, "We have no portion in David, and we," that's the tribes in the north, "have no inheritance in the son of Jesse, every man to his tent, so Israel." Now will you turn to 1 Kings chapter 12, and you'll see the same thing happening, you see, after the death of Solomon. First Kings 12 and verse 1. You notice that Solomon has died at the end of chapter 11. Rehoboam, that's Solomon's son, went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. And when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it, for he was still in Egypt, whither he had fled from King Solomon, then Jeroboam returned from Egypt. Now he's a troublemaker, this chap. This is the enemy you see. Of course, there's an enemy behind him, trying to wreck the work of God and split the people of God. They sent and called him. Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and said to Rehoboam, "Your father made our yoke heavy, all the taxes to build his marvelous palace and keep all the wives going. Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke upon us, and we will serve you." Rehoboam said to them, "Depart for 3 days, and then come again to me." And so the people went away. Then King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men who had stood before Solomon his father while he was yet alive, saying, "How do you advise me to answer this people?" And they said to him, "If you will be a servant to this people today and serve them, and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever." But Rehoboam forsook the counsel which the old men gave him. He didn't listen to that, and took counsel with the young men, the upstarts in the court, the ambitious chaps who had grown up with him and stood before him. And he said to them, "What do you advise that we answer this people who have said to me, 'Lighten the yoke that your father put upon us'?" And the young man who had grown up with him said to him, "Thus you shall speak to this people who said to you, 'Your father made our yoke heavy, but do you lighten it for us.' Thus shall you say to them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's loins.'" Here's a parable for you. "My little finger is thicker than my father Solomon's loins. And now, whereas my father laid upon you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions." So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king said, "Come to me again the third day." And the king answered the people harshly, and forsaking the counsel which the old men had given him, he spoke to them according to the counsel of the young men, the upstarts, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions." So the king did not hearken to the people, for it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord, that he might fulfill his word which the Lord spoke by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat, away back in a previous generation, that the kingdom would be divided. And when all Israel saw that the king did not hearken to them, the people answer the king, and it's interesting that they use the words that Sheba used in the time of King David. You see, there always was a spirit of division in God's people. And you find this, you know, in the early church in the book of Acts. No sooner has the church of Christ got off the ground, no sooner has the gospel of Christ begun to make headway in the ancient world, but you find the Christians quarreling. Even in Jerusalem, under the very shadow of Calvary, you find people gurning, arguing, and quarreling. It's the enemy of souls, you see. He splits the church of God. Chapter 12 and verse 16 of 1 Kings, same words, you see. And when all Israel saw that the king did not hearken to them, the people answered the king, "What portion have we in David?" Same words. "We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. We don't belong to what he's doing. To your tents, O Israel. Look now to your own house, David." And so Israel departed to their tents. You see, the real way of understanding these stories is to project them into New Testament terms. They are the shadows, but the kingdom of Christ, the church of Christ, the work of Christ, the person of Jesus Christ is the great reality. And sometimes it's very useful in studying the Old Testament to stand back from the text and say, where does all this fit into kingdom teaching? Where does this man stand in relation to God's kingdom? Where does this man fit into God's kingdom? What's happening here? This blood, this murder. Where does it fit into the work of God's kingdom? This man here, is he a part of God's kingdom? Is he in with the work of God, or is he just a hanger-on, somebody sitting on the fence? You see, it all relates to New Testament categories. You've got to project the shadows forwards into the reality. Now let's just think of that in relation to David and in relation to Joab. In 2 Samuel chapter 20, these marvelous words, and I don't think they're marvelous just because I happen to be a bachelor. Look at verse 3. King David locks up all his wives. David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house, and he put them in a house under guard and provided for them, but he did not go into them, and so they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. That was one of the best things that David ever did in his life. Lock up his harem, because they had made him soft. He had collected wives, you see. When he became a big man and thought he could get on fine without the help of God and his grace and his strength. And so he departed from God's law, because it's part of God's law that monogamy is the rule. That's not just Jewish teaching. That's not the law of Moses. It's the law of God. You find it in Genesis chapter 2. It's built into creation. One husband, one wife, monogamy. Whenever God's men drifted from God and drifted from his law in the Old Testament days, one of the things that they did was they began to multiply wives. Solomon, it reached its glory in the age of Solomon, who became a big man and the best thing that David ever did was to take all these women whom he had multiplied and lock them up. Do you know what lesson David had learned? Oh, I wish Christians would learn it. He had learned the resurrection power of evil. He had learned that you can slay a sin and it's still alive tomorrow. That's one of the messages of the book of Revelation, that you can deal with evil and deal with deep, indwelling sin. And you think it's dead. It comes alive again. For the life of me, I can't help thinking of the men who paint the fourth bridge. What a dismal job it must be. Have you ever thought of it? Same color of paint all your life. Same things you see all your life. And you've no sooner got to the end of the bridge than you have to take up all your tins of paint and walk back and start the other side. Because by the time you're at that side, it started to rust again over here. What a job. Must be very frustrating. And so it goes on and on and on. Now you see, there is in evil a resurrection power. John in Revelation speaks about a dragon that comes from the sea. And one of his heads looks as if it had been chopped off. But as soon as you chop off its head, more heads grow in its place. And it looks as if the beast has been slain, but it's still alive. And this is what David has learned to keep an eye on in his life. And so he takes his harem, this group of ladies who have made him soft and weak and self-indulgent, and he locks them up. Second great lesson in this chapter, if you look down to the woman, the wise woman, verse 16, she's called a wise woman. Later on it says that she went to the people in the city in all her wisdom. What made her wise? Verse 18, then she said, they were wont to say in old time, let them but ask counsel at Abel. And so they settled a matter. Now these great words, what made her wise? It's a grim story. What made her wise? I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy her city, which is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord? Joab answered, far be it from me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true, but a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba, the rebel, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David, the Lord's anointed. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city. And the woman said to Joab, is this what made her wise? Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall. Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom. Is this what made her wise? And they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and that was the end of the war. You know why she was a wise woman?
Because she knew the meaning of evangelical peace. You know what evangelical peace is? It's not like any other kind of peace. It's not like peace at any price. It's not like whitewashing over the dirt on a wall or patching up cracks. That's not evangelical peace. That's not real peace, you see, because it hasn't really sorted the problem. Evangelical peace is peace that is built on top of justice. What is it that C.S. Lewis says? That the flower of God's peace grows on the rocky soil of God's justice. Now that's what she knew. The chappie was a rebel. He deserved to die. And the only thing that would bring peace was the death of Sheba. There's a great passage in the Old Testament. I'll read it to you. Just one verse. How to conduct a holy war. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace. Isn't that great? For a Christian warrior, how to fight for Jesus Christ in the world today. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, it's almost a contradiction. When you draw near to fight, offer peace. Offer terms of peace. And if it answers to you, then that's fine. And it's only when the city doesn't respond that you go to war. See, this was the great thing about this wifey. Peace first. It's always first. If you find yourself amongst non-Christians, as you're certainly likely to do in today's world, first thing you offer them is peace. Not judgment and sin and hell. Not first. Jesus didn't do it, and neither should you. The woman of Samaria had a rotten life. Jesus was very kind to her. The man up the tree, the wee man, what's his name? Zacchaeus. A little twister of a man. What did Jesus say to him? Did Jesus preach a long sermon about hell and everlasting punishment? They're real, you know. I do not disbelieve in them. Jesus said, 7:30 tonight, dinner in your house, if you don't mind. And he got converted. And I dare say that the critics weren't helping. Peace first. I mean evangelical peace. I mean peace built on justice. I mean honorable peace. I mean the peace that you see in the death of Jesus Christ. One of our hymns speaks about righteous peace, securely made. The peace that you find in the death of Christ isn't a sham peace that pastes over the cracks and tries to whitewash all the dirt. That's not real peace. That's fraudulent. That's dishonest. But that peace is righteous peace, securely made. And it's that you offer first
Oh, I wish Christians would learn this. I wish young ministers would learn it. I know young men who have gone into churches and who have almost wrecked their ministries because they went into the pulpit and they rampaged about judgment and sin and hell. And they spoiled their ministries. I know Christians too in everyday life who spoil their testimony for Christ because what they preach first of all is not this righteous peace securely made. You know the story of the bishop, and he had a curate preaching, and the curate preached for one or two months, and he went to the bishop and he said, "What did you think of it?" "Well," the bishop said, "you're doing not badly, you know, but I do wish you would stop referring to the congregation as the opposition." See, that's not the way to do it. Jesus didn't do it. And if it was good enough for him, surely it's good enough for you. And the damage that's done by failure to see this. Mr. Sims, someone at the door. Someone trying to get in. The damage that's done by failure to see this. I had a widow complaining to me about the minister who had taken her funeral, not here. And she said that in all the funeral service there wasn't a vestige of comfort. Now I know it was a problematic funeral, and I don't think that her husband was a Christian, and perhaps the minister found it very difficult. But surely you can find something kind to say to people under circumstances such as these. Surely you can offer the peace of God, and I mean the peace of God. I mean evangelical peace. Not soothing words. Not sentimental words that don't mean anything. But real peace. And this terrible chap had got up and gone on about sin, hellfire, and damnation, and judgment, and the poor woman bleeding in pain. That's what this wifey recognized. That's what this wifey learned, and that's what's made her a wise, wise woman. Evangelical peace, a peace built upon justice. Let's learn from her, shall we? Now our closing hymn is 485. O brother man, fold to thy heart thy brother, and the tune is O Perfect Love.